This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. The estimated value of the pollination that honeybees provide to grow crops in the United States is $15 billion annually. Bees also ensure the survival of 35% of the world's food output each year. But with Wisconsin losing around 45% of its bee population every winter, the outlook for bee health and survival is ominous. Thomas Rehfeldt has more on what's threatening bees in the area, why it matters, and what's being done to improve the habitat for bees.
You can see they're starting to fill honey in there, bring in nectar, putting it in there.
This is Oscar Carlson, a former professor of entomology at UW-Stout and an avid apiarist with over 40 years of experience both keeping bees and a coat of welts on his body to prove it. We are just outside of La Crescent, inspecting one of Carlson's hives.
Well, what you're doing here is looking for mites. And like I say, I would bet strongly that this is a mite right here.
The speck of a parasite he's referring to rests on the top of a thin slip of sheet metal pulled from the bottom of the hive. This apparatus is known as a cortex sheet, and today it has captured the largest pest threatening the health of bee colonies across the world.
Somewhere in the 1980s, a person brought honeybees over from Europe, and they had the mites, the Varroa mite, which is a mite that's on the outside of the bee. It's for its action, it's much like having a leech on you. It sucks the blood of the bee.
They're one of the biggest challenges that beekeepers face today.
Liz Miles is the chief apiarist for the state of Wisconsin.
They're in almost every beehive in every country of the world.
Eliminating the Varroa mite is a major task, since the reproductive success of the mite corresponds with the emergence of juvenile bees. Harsh chemical treatments are the most effective means to control infestation. Unfortunately, these chemicals, such as concentrated phenol, are precarious for the health of the bees. However, Varroa mites are just one challenge compounding the litany of factors diminishing the health of the honeybee. Since 2006, the recognition of an undiagnosed spectrum of mysterious bee disappearances called colony collapse disorder, or CCD, has decimated honeybee colonies. Carlson, as well as Miles, believes that CCD is correlated to mites, viruses, and pesticides.
And they're also struggling with habitat loss or inadequate forage, and that leads to poor nutrition, and not to mention the stress of being trucked around the country to pollinate our food. So there's a lot they're battling right now.
Beekeepers like Carlson say the desire to create efficient monocultures for industrial agricultural production threatens the availability of adequate nutrition and compromises the bee's immune system. Miles says the variety of nectar may come from an overlooked source.
They're not getting much out of the corn and soybeans. They probably get more out of the weeds along the fence rows, if there are any left, than they would be getting from the corn and soybeans.
Honeybees and all pollinators are seen as the keystones between the flora and fauna of an environment. They are estimated to pollinate 1/6 of all plant species inhabiting the globe. Plants like cotton, coffee, and cranberries, things you find on a farm.
So this hive we put in April, beginning of April.
This is Hoke Orchard in La Crescent, near where Oscar Carlson keeps his bees.
A lot of the issue comes to the amount of feeding that the big commercial growers do with the bees.
Harry Hoke is a second-generation apple grower, and in his continuous quest to reduce the environmental impact on his farm, has sought methods that promote biodiversity. Like Carlson, Harry Hoke believes today's farming techniques and commercial honey production overlooks the diversity of pollen and nectar sources that honeybees require.
Commercial growers take away as much honey as they possibly can and then refeed them with sugar syrup. So it's kind of like taking a good balanced diet away and then just adding a bunch of candy.
In the eyes of beekeepers like Carlson, there is a simple solution that enables everyone in improving the habitat for honeybees.
I just wish that people would plant some of the types of plants that the bees can really forage on. Sweet clover, birds for trefoil. Basswood trees takes a while to get them to that particular point.
Harry Hoke punctuates the importance of not only what is grown from the earth, but to be attentive to the ways we treat and tend to our yards and gardens.
The bigger call to action is going to be all the individuals. You know, what is your effect on the environment? Are you spraying things on your grass to make it greener, to kill off certain flowers and weeds, and what's happening in their own yards and their own acreages?
While breeding programs and research in Minnesota is creating bees with stronger social grooming habits, in 2014, the USDA introduced a new wildflower incentive for current participants of the Conservation Reserve Program. The Bee Incentive Program has the potential to influence nearly 245,000 acres of qualified land within Wisconsin. Earlier this year, a preliminary survey by the Bee Informed Partnership suggested Wisconsin lost 60% of its beehives from 2014 to 2015. Beekeepers say planting bee gardens and being mindful of fertilizer use is a start to improving conditions for honeybees. Thomas Rehfeldt, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio and La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. From the apple orchards of La Crescent to the alfalfa fields near Bangor, honeybees play an important role in the food supply. La Crosse County UW Extension Director Mary Meehan Strube talked with a regional panel of beekeepers about their experience with the decline of honeybee populations. Marla Spivak is a professor at the University of Minnesota's Department of Entomology. Matt LaForge is the vice president of the Wisconsin Honey Producers Association. Wayne Lamar is vice president of the La Crosse Area Beekeepers Association. Wayne talks about his long history with beekeeping.
I've been involved since 1985 when I started beekeeping. I'm not a large beekeeper, I'm just a hobbyist, but have been involved during that time and have been involved with the La Crosse Area Beekeepers for at least 20 or 21 years. I was president of the La Crosse Area Beekeepers for 19 years. I'm now demoted to vice president.
Where are your bees at, Wayne?
My bees are just outside of La Crosse, about 6 miles.
And Matt, how long have you been involved with beekeeping?
I started beekeeping about 15 years ago when I was just 11 years old. Started with one hive in the backyard, and it's grown from there. And I've been involved with the Wisconsin Honey Producers now for about 3 years. And now I'm the vice president.
And Marla, I'm not sure, you do a different kind of beekeeping aspect. How long have you been involved?
Well, I started beekeeping in 1974. It's been a long time. And I worked for commercial beekeepers, not in up here, but it was in New Mexico and then in Colorado. And then I went into research, and I've been at the University of Minnesota since 1992. Doing research on bees.
Wayne, can you tell us a little bit about the La Crosse Area Beekeepers?
Yes, we meet the third Tuesday of the month in the old administrative building, county administrative building in the basement. And our mission is to educate and inform and help our existing beekeepers and to encourage new beekeepers. And we also do give presentations to schools and other organizations. And we cover a 7-county area, 5 counties in Wisconsin, La Crosse, Monroe, Jackson, Trempealeau, and then we cover 2 counties in Minnesota, Winona and Houston County. We try to educate the public as well through presentations. We've been hopefully successful at doing that.
Matt, tell us a little bit about the Wisconsin Honey Producers.
The Wisconsin Honey Producers has a couple missions. We want to educate the public about bees and the benefit of honey, the value of honey and pollination. And to do that, one of our biggest outreach things is the Wisconsin Honey Queen, who goes around the state talking to school groups especially, but she does a lot of radio interviews and TV interviews too, talking about the use of the honey, the issues with honeybees, and just generally promoting education for the public. We also are at the Wisconsin State Fair every year, and that's an excellent opportunity for us to talk to literally thousands of people who come and tell them about the importance of honeybees. Another major thing we do is focus on educating beekeepers, and we have several meetings throughout the year for that. There's two statewide meetings, one in July every year, and then one around Halloween time. And then in the spring, there's some district meetings, more local meetings around the state where beekeepers can get together and bring in researchers, commercial beekeepers who just share knowledge and try to promote better beekeeping.
So what's happening in the honeybee population?
Well, honeybees are hurting, I would say. It's hard to keep bees alive. Probably Wayne remembers, and maybe Matt remembers well, even 10 years ago it was a lot easier to keep a colony of bees living year after year. But right now it's just hard to keep them healthy, and there's things we can control, and there's things that are mysterious and seem to be out of our control.
So when you say they're not healthy, what's actually happening to them?
Well, Wayne, why don't you, or Matt, why don't you try to explain, and then I can do a science backup on it.
Well, I can give you an example. Some of the bees that I purchased, some of the packages that I purchased this year, and some of the nukes that I purchased, and that was in the beginning of April, and they started out doing very well, and then they go for a month or 6 weeks or 10 weeks, and all of a sudden they start to depopulate, and the bees seem to vanish, they disappear, and then the queen quits laying, and when she quits laying, then they usually dispose of her. And if the bees didn't build some queen cells to replace the old queen, then your hive is in trouble. And that is happening this spring, and there's a lot of it. And it's very difficult to know what's causing it. I guess I'll let Marla, maybe she can explain what's causing it.
Well, what we see is about one in three colonies fail, and they can be new colonies and old colonies, and they fail from a number of reasons. So with these brand new colonies, like Wayne was just talking about, we're seeing a lot of queen failure for reasons we don't understand. The queen just stops laying eggs, or she's replaced by the workers replace her by raising a new queen. We see a little bit of the colonies dwindling and disappearing, like Wayne was explaining, but we're not seeing as much of that. We see a lot of problems with the parasitic mites. Varroa is the name of the mite, and they really can take down a colony in the fall, especially established colonies. So many, many reasons why colonies are failing. And like I said, some of them we understand, like the Varroa mites, and some of them, like the queen problems, we really don't have a good handle on what's going on there.
Marla, does any of that relate to what they call colony collapse disorder?
Possibly. Originally, colony collapse disorder was a name given to these symptoms when bees would mysteriously leave the hive or not be found. And you would have a good, strong colony, and then a few weeks later, you'd go back, and the colony hardly had any bees in it. The queen might be there, and all their food stores were still there, but there would be very few bees. So those particular symptoms we still see, but not very often. Now, more often, we're seeing all kinds of different things. Like in those symptoms, colony collapse disorder, the queen would still be present in the colony. And what we're seeing now is a lot of, well, the queen's not in the colony, but there's either a lot of bees or few bees. We're seeing every combination of events, I would say.
Does it matter that the honeybee population is declining?
It's very important for our food supply. About one in every three bites of food that we consume relies directly or indirectly on honeybee pollination. Obviously, the ones that everybody thinks of right away are fruit crops, apples, cherries, those kind of things that rely directly on honeybee pollination. But even things like dairy rely indirectly on it because those cows are fed alfalfa. That alfalfa comes from seed that's pollinated by honeybees. So if there's not enough bees to travel around the country and pollinate crops at the right time, at the time when they're blooming and the bees are needed, it could have major impacts on our food supply.
When you talk about the alfalfa that's fed to the cows, and of course a lot of the dairy producers will cut that alfalfa at what they call first bud, does that impact what's available for the honeybees?
Yes, it does impact the food source for the bees, because I used to get quite a bit of honey that was, the alfalfa was the food source from neighboring farms. And now they cut it at first bud, and the bees do not have access to that, and so it's less nutrition. This nutrition problem is pretty broad. We used to have a lot of grasslands and alfalfa and flowers in the fence rows and so forth, and there was a lot of nutrition for the bees. Now the farmers plow the grasslands under so they can plant cash crops like beans, soybeans, and grains, and the bees do not visit corn and soybeans, so you have these monocrop situations where the bees really don't have a source of nectar to rely on. So that is a contributing factor as well.
Yeah, I would also say there's a lot of herbicide use, much, much more herbicide use than we've ever seen. Because of Roundup Ready crops, even alfalfa, they're able to spray a lot of herbicide, which kills off a lot of the flowering plants on the border of crops and roadsides, and those are all food plants for bees that they really, really need. And in addition to the nectar that they use to make honey, of course, bees really need a lot of pollen, their protein source. And we're finding through our research that it's the pollen flow, I'll call it, the amount of pollen coming into a colony over the growing season for the bees that makes such a difference to their health and survivorship. So there's just a lot fewer flowers out there for the bees. It's kind of sad.
In reading about what's happening to the bee population today, if you read, you'll see that commercial beekeepers are going to say that they need to have that it's the insecticides that are causing the issue. But then the insecticide manufacturers blame the mites that you mentioned earlier. And then when you read more, you find environmentalists will say, well, it's the habitat loss, similar to what Wayne has just talked about here. And then they're saying it's not any one pesticide, but it could be a combination. So bottom line, and you also, Marla, talked about the genetically modified seeds that we have available out there. Is it the combination, or does any one of those stand out as the main cause?
I would say all of the above.
And we're starting to learn more and more about how they impact each other, too. The mites might weaken the bees, which makes them more susceptible and less able to detoxify pesticides. And the pesticides, in turn, weaken the bees, which makes them more susceptible and Matt is able to fend off mites. They just two examples, and the viruses that the mites transmit. So really, it's kind of a perfect storm, and everything builds off of each other. And where maybe the bees could handle one or two of these things at one time, with all of them combined, it just wears them down to nothing.
When did it first start, or when was your first notice that there's a change in the bee population, and what were the signs that they were disappearing?
Statistics show that in 1947, the United States had 6 million colonies of bees, and today we have about 2.7 million colonies of bees. So they have been declining for a long time. But it really came to the forefront with the colony collapse disorder.
I would agree with that. Bees have been in decline for a very, very long time. And when the parasitic mite Varroa was introduced in the late 80s, the bees really struggled with that. So they've been struggling since then, even more than they were before. But just within the last 10 years, even more pronounced problems are happening that are building on previous problems.
I would agree with that same thing. My whole beekeeping experience has been post-Varroa mite invasion. But when I started beekeeping, the challenge with beekeeping was keeping the bees alive over winter. In the summer, you could kind of let them do their thing. They'd go out, make honey. You'd make sure they were healthy and had plenty of food in fall. And it was fairly simple. Now, hives can collapse. They can fall apart any time during the year. It's not just winter losses. In the last several years, these are season-long losses where you have to constantly be taken care of, and it's a lot more active management beekeeping.
Yeah, I would agree with that. When I started keeping bees, it seemed like they survived in spite of everything I did.
It's true.
Today, biologists have found more than 150 different pesticides that are out there for the bees to be and other pollinators to be exposed to. So that's been, and this is from statistics from the University of Georgia.
Yeah, actually, in Penn State University, and they found all of those pesticides in pollen that bees are bringing back as food. And they're not just insecticides, and they're not just one class of insecticides. They include all the herbicides and all the fungicides and all the classes of insecticides. So bees are out there sweeping the environment as they eat, and they bring home lots and lots of toxins, not necessarily at lethal doses or concentrations, but sometimes at levels that don't hurt them, sometimes they can. And all those things, like Matt was saying, just wear them down. And it's not just that, because inside the colony they have problems too.
Now, I understand that it is a condition of populations of what they call feral honeybees that might be a major concern, but before I go into feral honeybees, can you tell me what are the different kinds of honeybees?
There's just one species of honeybee in the United States, and its scientific name is Apis mellifera, and it was introduced from Europe. There's several races, or that's the same as saying a subspecies of honeybee, but there's just one kind of honeybee in the whole United States. And they were managed, they were brought over in boxes, and some of them escaped, they formed, they reproduced, and they colonized trees. And those that are living in trees we call feral honeybees. But there are a lot of wild kinds of bees that are not honeybees, and in fact, in North America we have about 4,000 species of wild native bees that have always been here. And they're quite different from honeybees. Most of them are solitary. A few of them live in small social colonies, like bumblebees are social. But none of them live in a very large colony like honeybees, and none of them produce honey that we can harvest.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm Mary Meehan Strube, and we're talking about the plight of honeybees with our guest today. Marla Spivak is a professor in the Department of Entomology at the University of Minnesota. Wayne Lamar is vice president of the La Crosse Area Beekeepers Association, and Matt LaForge is vice president of the Wisconsin Honey Producers Association. What's being done to reduce the decline of honeybees today?
Through a grant from the USDA to some researchers, we started this project that we call the Tech Transfer Teams, or Tech Teams, and they're groups of professional young beekeepers that go and help commercial beekeepers monitor diseases and mite pests, and they can help them with some bee breeding, and they just give them colony health reports at regular intervals and a very quick turnaround, just to help beekeepers monitor the health of their colonies. So they've never had assistance like that, and they really, really need it at this time.
You talk about tech transfer teams and young producers, and when we traditionally think of farmers, there's all the discussion about the average age of farmers are increasing. What are you finding in terms of, I'll call them farmers who do honeybee production?
The average age of commercial beekeepers is definitely increasing, and because of all the challenges in the industry, a lot of times when these beekeepers retire, the next generation doesn't want to come in and pick it up. So we are losing commercial beekeepers at a pretty alarming rate. There is a surge in interest in small-scale backyard beekeeping, and that really hits every possible age and demographic that you can possibly imagine. And that's been a huge silver lining in this, is just the public awareness of beekeeping and the increased small-scale beekeeping. It's not going to be able to do the same thing for our food supply that commercial beekeepers can, bringing in large number of colonies to pollinate crops. But as far as for the bee population as a whole, these young, old, this new crop of small-scale beekeepers is really a blessing.
So what's attracting them to this?
I think one thing is attracting them is their concern for nature and their concern for the honeybees. And as Matt said earlier, they're learning that pollination affects every third bite of food that they take. And we have seen here in this area a strong concern, a strong interest, I should say, in beekeeping. We have two members of our La Crosse Area Beekeepers, Oscar Carlson and Bob Hoffman, who run classes for beekeeping, and last spring they had over 100 people register for a class beginning beekeeping, and that shows that there's a strong interest in beekeeping and a strong concern.
That's really true. At the University of Minnesota, we've always taught a beekeeping short course, a weekend how-to course. Until about 2009, we had 60, maybe up 100 people once a year. And now we have 250 people three times a year.
Marla Spivak is a University of Minnesota professor of entomology. Wayne Lamar is vice president of the La Crosse Area Beekeepers Association, and Matt LaForge is vice president of the Wisconsin Honey Producers Association. They've been talking with La Crosse County UW Extension Director Mary Meehan Strube about the disappearance of the honeybee. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up, we'll continue our discussion, focusing on what farmers and the average person can do to create a better world for bees. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. There, you'll also find a link to a YouTube video of Marla Spivak talking about the decline of bees. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at WPR.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. People do have the power to reduce the decline of the honeybees. That's according to the panel of area beekeepers we've been talking with on today's show. Marla Spivak is a University of Minnesota Department of Entomology professor. Wayne Lamar is vice president of the La Crosse Area Beekeepers Association. And Matt LaForge is vice president of the Wisconsin Honey Growers Association. La Crosse County UW Extension Director Mary Meehan Strub asks Matt LaForge how important farmers are to the future of bees.
Farmers really control a huge portion of land, and land that bees formerly depended on. Despite all the wonderful and very helpful initiatives that the government has started to plant pollinator-friendly things on public lands and even outside public office buildings, the amount of land dedicated to agriculture is very important to bees. So really getting some education and, as Marla said earlier, some possibly federal incentives for farmers to dedicate some hedgerows, dedicate even the marginal land to honeybee forage and native bee habitat is absolutely crucial.
What can the average person do? You know, the person who, you know, just lives in a house in town or house in the country, what can they do to make a difference?
They can do two things. They can plant flowers that bees like, and they can try to keep those flowers free of contamination from any kind of herbicide or insecticide or fungicide. So it's just putting out food for flowers. And as far as what flowers they should be, it's fairly easy if you go out at this time of year and you walk around in some public gardens where there's signage and some flowers you see bees all over, all kinds of bees, native bees, wild bees, honeybees, and other flowers you don't see any bees on them on a nice, warm, sunny day. And so those that are attractive to bees, you write down the name and you go buy those and plant those.
Things that bloom very early in the spring or very late in the fall are especially valuable. That's usually when the bees need it the most and when there's the least available. So people should look for year-round blooms, too. Those are very helpful for the honeybees.
That's a great point.
Is there something called a bee garden? We've had butterfly gardens. We've had rain gardens. Should we be planning for bee gardens?
Most definitely. And a lot of gardening groups throughout the United States are coming up with mixes right now. And so I think just keep your eye open. Nurseries, I think in the next few years, there's going to be a lot of places selling mixes and seed mixes and potted plants for your bee and pollinator garden. There's already a lot of places that sell seed mixes. And a lot of them include a lot of native flowering plants, which are somewhat helpful for our honeybees, but they also really help our native bees.
You mentioned earlier, Marla, the roadway kinds of concepts, whether it's the dividers on the interstate and that. Can they be designed so that they would be bee-friendly but yet not create traffic accidents?
Traffic accidents for the people or the bees? That's what I worry about, the bees.
Well, maybe both.
Yeah, I used to think that we flowering highways would be really good, but I do worry a little bit about all the salt we use and all the herbicide we use and all the pollution, heavy metals that come from our cars. Every time you apply the brakes, there's heavy metals that get into the roadsides. I think better places might be utility rights-of-way, a lot of our power lines and railroads that we're not using, yards, marginal land and farmland and those kind of areas, county roads that don't receive a lot of traffic and don't have so much salt on them. I think there's a lot of habitat, there's a lot of area where we could increase the number of flowering plants out there. Of course, our highways, our interstates, are really visible and would be beautiful with flowering plants, but we would have to change some of the way we maintain our roads.
And what about native prairie?
That's actually a big topic of research in my lab right now, because the question is, would native prairie flowers help honeybees. We know that they would really, really help all of our native bees and other pollinators. They really help our monarch butterflies, for example. But could honeybees create a honey crop from a native prairie? And so you'll have to stay tuned. We're have colonies out in some prairie sites that are really seeded heavily with flowers. And some of them are close to Wisconsin, really close, by Afton. And we have these colonies out there, and we're looking at the dance language of the honeybees. So bees, when they find a good nectar source, they do this dance language communication. And we're observing the dances and kind of eavesdropping in on them to see if the bees are dancing to any of the flowers that are in the prairies. And we collect pollen from those bees, and so we can tell exactly what plant they've been on. So we're hoping that they are using the prairies, but I have a feeling that our honeybees prefer areas where there's big patches, dense stands of flowers, like when clover grows or alfalfa is grown and basswood trees that are really dense patches. That's what our honeybees really like.
You know, you talk about the honeybee dances, but then you also mention the flowering food that they use. In the area of research, is there anything going on that's looking towards finding a better bee food or a better source of bee food?
Well, the bees would tell us what the best bee food is through their dances, because mm-hmm. they only do a dance when the flowers they find are really high quality and what I would call profitable to them, so really high energy. So they would tell us. And we know what a lot of the really good bee flowers are. Clover, all kinds of clover are really good for honeybees. Alfalfa is very good for honeybees. There's a lot of vetches. In the native plants, Anna's hyssop is a really good flower for bees, but it's never planted in high enough density so that bees could really make a honey crop from it. If it was, it would be amazing.
There's a lot of private commercial research and interest going into making supplemental food for bees. Artificial protein is a big one. And that really does help colonies when the natural forage isn't available. It helps colonies when they're under stress because of diseases and that kind of thing. And there have been huge strides in that, and it's come a long, long way. And we really have some very good food for bees to help them when they really need it. But nothing will ever compare to the real thing.
Thinking of here in Wisconsin, actually here in La Crosse County as well, how many beekeepers are there in this area in Wisconsin, Wayne?
Our organization, the membership is about 50 plus members, and we're getting new members all the time. And Matt, I'm sure, could give you some idea of statewide in the WHPA membership.
For the Wisconsin honey producers, we do have a couple hundred members, 300-400. That's only a very small fraction of the number of beekeepers. Really, in the state of Wisconsin, after the past 5 or 6 years where there's been this huge surge in interest in small-scale backyard beekeeping, there are literally thousands of beekeepers in the state of Wisconsin. In every city, every town, I'm sure there's someone on your street who's a beekeeper and you probably don't even know it, but there's a lot of us out there.
So how does that compare then, Marla, with what's available in Minnesota?
Well, Minnesota has a lot of commercial beekeepers and a lot of backyard beekeepers. We don't have a state apiary program. In other words, we don't have a mandatory state registration program, so we really have no idea how many beekeepers there are. But I know the hobby group in the Twin Cities area has at least 400 members, and when I go to the monthly meetings, there's often 200 people there, and that's not just a fraction of all the beekeepers there are in the state.
So do we need more?
We need more commercial beekeepers.
Yeah.
We need those people that are willing to pollinate our fruit and vegetable crops and our any other thing that needs pollinating.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm Mary Meehan Strube, and today we're talking about the plight of the honeybee with our guest Marla Spivak, a professor in the Department of Entomology at the University of Minnesota, Wayne Lamar, Vice President of the La Crosse Area Beekeepers Association, and Matt LaForge, Vice President of the Wisconsin Honey Producers Association. As you've worked with this over the last several years, do you find that the issue of honeybees is a politically charged issue?
Not so much politically charged. It's more heart charged. I think people are really feeling bad that the honeybees are in decline, and that's why there's such increased public awareness around it. I think honeybees are bipartisan. I really don't think that they're on any side of the political spectrum. Everybody likes them. We know that we need them.
And I understand that the White House has taken notice of the issue with honeybees. Is there enough concern about this issue in the U.S. and in the world?
It's certainly increasing. It's great that the White House has made it one of their campaigns to protect pollinators. And there's going to be a lot of planting of habitat on federal lands. What I would like to see a little bit more of is some incentives, some money appropriated behind it. There, of course, is some more for research, but what I would really like to see is money appropriated to farmers, for example, to be able to, instead of planting corn and soybeans from the roadside to the ditches, if they were given some incentives, financial incentives, to plant pollinator habitat as strips, for example, that would really be helpful. And I think all farmers would do that, but they would need to be compensated. I think it would be a really helpful thing for our environment. When we plant pollinator habitat, it's what I'll call stacked benefits or multiple benefits, because that kind of grass and especially flowering plants prevents soil erosion, and it keeps the nitrogen in the soil. It, of course, helps our bees and other pollinators, and it provides bird habitat, songbird habitat, wild game bird habitat. So there's a lot of benefits to putting in pollinator habitat in many locations.
Would you liken that to going back to the way it used to be, more natural?
I guess you could say that. The organic movement is a movement that is in that direction, and it definitely is favorable to the pollinators. And I'm sure that we will see some benefit from that.
We've talked about the decline and what's happening with honeybees, not only in Wisconsin, but across the U.S. And if we look at the business of raising honeybees, raising honey, how is that business being impacted by this decline in honeybees?
Well, for commercial beekeepers, it's really tough to make a living right now. So if bees were cattle and the rancher was losing a third of his livestock every year, like beekeepers lose a third of their bee colonies every year, it's very difficult to maintain your business financially. With bees, unlike cattle, you can colonies that survive, you can split them in two. This is a common beekeeping management technique, and you purchase or raise a new queen bee and you put it in part of the new split. So you can take an existing colony and make two out of it. And that's what beekeepers are doing to replace their losses. And it comes at a lot of labor expense and financial expense to make sure that they can keep their numbers up just for pollination and to sell other beekeepers bees. So all the new beekeepers that want bees, they're purchasing them from commercial beekeepers for the most part. And those are the same commercial beekeepers that are trying to keep their numbers in high enough so they can pollinate crops and provide bees. So it's very, very difficult right now.
Is it a costly venture to raise honeybees?
Well, the way it's been going lately, it's not very profitable because... Like Marla said, if you lose a third or even a half of your stock, it costs you to either purchase packages or nukes, or even if you split your old colonies, you reduce the strength of that colony, and that reduces your income because the bees produce less honey.
As I think back over the last couple of years and listening to media sources, I hear nationally in some cases that honey production's up. But here in Wisconsin, honey production's down. Or that the honey-producing colonies are up nationally and the trend is opposite here in the state. Is that accurate?
The honey production of Wisconsin, say, obviously the number of colonies that are here is important, but that generally there haven't been huge swings up or down from one year to the next. I mean, there's a definite trend, but not huge swings from year to year. The season does matter a lot for honey production, just like for any kind of agriculture. Different areas of the state, if they get more or less rain at the right or wrong time, and that can make a big difference. Wisconsin dropped out of the top 10 honey-producing states last year. That was, I mean, despite all the problems with the bees, that wasn't because of any like specific bee crisis last year. A lot of it was just because it wasn't a great year for honey. So that plays a part, too.
How much honey does an average colony produce?
The average the statewide average in Wisconsin in an average year is right about 60 pounds.
In Minnesota, it's about the same. And I'll tell you, 20 years ago when I first moved here, it was well over 100 pounds on average. And the difference is just lack of flowers.
In comparing our 60 pounds that are average here, how does that compare with what the average is nationally?
Well, it really varies state by state. So, you know, that in parts of North Dakota, they can get a 100-pound average, maybe higher. In parts of the southern states, they may make 30 or 50 pounds. So it really varies. I think as Matt was saying, Wisconsin was in the top 10 honey producers. Minnesota's usually in the top 5 or 6. North Dakota's usually number 1. South Dakota is usually 2 or 3. So the upper Midwest is the best honey-producing region of the United States. California and Florida also produce a lot of honey, but they have a lot of beekeepers. But the per colony yield is highest in the upper Midwest.
Thinking globally, what will the world be like if we keep losing honeybees at this rate?
Well, we have seen in the Far East, in Japan, for example, I don't really know the history of why, but we see pictures of people climbing into cherry trees and pollinating them with a small brush or a feather because they do not have pollinators to do that.
I've seen the same from China with pear trees and apple trees. And some of that's when they plant a variety that's not attractive to bees and they have people go out and hand pollinate them. But I don't think we want to be up in all of our trees moving pollen manually. I think that would not be a good state of affairs, especially when the bees are so good at doing it themselves.
What's the best case scenario for the future with honeybees?
Well, if we could restore some of the original vegetation and forested areas to produce pollen for our pollinators, and if we could reduce the type of insecticides that are being used, if we could back off on that, would certainly help.
I agree. If we could restore a lot of the flowering plants and be really careful with our herbicide use, and also our insecticide use and even our fungicide use. There's just a lot of toxins out there for the bees. And so just like people want good, clean food, and we're really paying attention to our human nutrition, bees really want and need the same thing. They really need a lot of good, clean food. And if we can help provide that for them, they in turn provide us with good, clean food through their pollination services.
Marla Spivak is a professor in the Department of Entomology at the University of Minnesota. Wayne Lamar is vice president of the La Crosse Area Beekeepers Association. And Matt LaForge is vice president of the Wisconsin Honey Growers Association. They spoke with La Crosse County UW Extension Director Mary Meehan Strube about why honeybee populations are declining. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. Our production team includes Thomas Rehfeld, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at WPR.org/newsmakers. Our site also has other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at WPR.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, photos, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.